This is April 26th, 2015, and today's Teisha will be a continuation of last week's regarding digital technology and the social media. It's an enormous topic. As I said last week, it's taken me years to even halfway get my arms around this topic. And so I'm not going to begin to really in a thorough way address everything, but because of the effects of digital technology and social media on the mind, how we use our time, issues of the self and identity, of separation versus intimacy, issues of control, of trust, of relationships, of freedom versus addiction, compulsiveness, issues of authenticity. These are all at the core of Zen practice and why we practice Zen. Again, as I said last week, I strongly suspect that for most people who are hearing this, they're part of the choir to which I'm preaching. I don't have any reason to think that many people in our own Sangha have significant problems with these things, with digital technology and social media, and that most people can have learned how to use these things and not be used by them. That is, they find a balance between how they can help in one's life in a sort of a practical way of convenience and stopping short of them getting these effects consuming one. But I think also that most people who are hearing this now, maybe the majority, are digital immigrants, and it may be much harder for digital natives, people who have grown up with these things and have never known anything, many other ways of relating than through these things. So I'm just going to forge in here, and I'm going to be reading from a great book on this matter that many other writers quote from. It's called Alone Together by Sherry Turkle. Last week I talked mostly about digital technology in general, and in this one I'm going to be talking more about social media, Facebook and other forms of social media and the dangers. Again, I'll be focusing on the dangers of these things, the excesses, to bring some balance to what I think is a lot of people just drinking the Kool-Aid and thinking that this is the most wonderful thing, or if not thinking it's the most wonderful thing ever devised, at least being really caught in it. So I went through this book, and right now, just the introduction, I jotted down some points she makes in introduction, and I'll start by commenting on those and then weaving in material from other articles. She says, we look to technology for ways to be in relationships and protect ourselves from them at the same time. We expect more from technology and less from each other. We seem determined to give human qualities to objects and content to treat each other as things. About 40% of her book is about robots, robot companions. And I just skipped over that as just... it's just too hard for me to even relate to. I suppose for digital natives, it's not at all remote as a thing they have to deal with. We are lonely but fearful of intimacy, she says. And this is one of the most terrible potential side effects of this, of social media, is the loss of a sense of intimacy, because being connected is not the same as true intimacy, being connected in a digital way. And Zen practice is really about, it's a practice of intimacy, becoming, through meditation, we become more intimate with who we are most authentically. And in that way, we find ourselves willy-nilly becoming more intimate with others and with things and with the circumstances and conditions of our life. You could say that intimacy is right at the core of Zen practice. And yet, what passes for connection in social media is anything but intimacy. She says, our networked life allows us to hide from each other even as we're tethered to each other. We'd rather text than talk. Other articles have talked about this, how texting now is the preferred mode of communication among young people, and I hear even from adults in the Sangha who say that they've had to go to texting if they wanted to stay in touch with their kids. So many articles. I left half of them out. Well, here's just a short one. I wrote in at the top of this short article, alas, and it's a report from, someone gave it to me, United Airlines Hemispheres magazine from March of this year, last month, and that's datelined Cambodia, about monks in Cambodia who are completely caught up in social media and digital technology. It is common to see monks toting iPads and smartphones. Many have their own Facebook pages. To deny young initiates media access, as everyone here understands, would likely lead to a severe drop in the number of monks. At Wat Priya Prum Rath, Wat is sort of means a temple, more or less, in Southeast Asia. At that temple, there are two satellite dishes on the temple roof and a big screen television in the communal dining room. The head monk says they used to eat in silence. Now they want action kung fu movies from Hong Kong. There are just too many distractions. This head monk admits to having difficulty accepting the newfound worldliness of his young charges, but he tries to keep an open mind. One can still pursue the path to enlightenment while living in the modern world, he says. It is just harder with so much access to pornography. In Sherry Turkle's book. Oh, by the way, Sherry Turkle is a psychologist at MIT, or at least last I heard, she was at MIT. And she wrote this book under the auspices of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self. And there's a chapter here she calls Growing Up Tethered. And the first, right at the beginning, the first paragraph, she poses the question, why did they text while driving? Now, this is a question that's come to me a lot. First of all, how do you text while driving in any even faintly responsible way? And then she says, oh, by the way, the book is based on field research. It's not; these are not opinions of hers. They're her extensive interviews with many high school and college students, and then her interpretations and conclusions based on that. So why do they text while driving? Their reasons are not reasons. They simply express a need to connect. And then she quotes someone, I interrupt a call even if the new call says unknown as an identifier. I just have to know who it is. So I'll cut off a friend for an unknown, says Maury. I need to know who wanted to connect. And if I hear my phone, I have to answer it. I don't have a choice. I have to know who it is, what they are calling for. And then she says these young people live in a state of waiting for connection. She asks a group, when was the last time you felt that you didn't want to be interrupted? I expect to hear many stories. There are none. Silence. I'm waiting to be interrupted right now, one says. For him, what I would term interruption is the beginning of a connection. So this is right at the heart of all this, this need for connection. But she makes some very strong points about this based on her many interviews. She says that networked life, in networked life, we imagine it as expansive, but we are just as fond of its constraints. We celebrate its weak ties, the bonds of acquaintance with people we may never meet. People talk about the pleasures of these weak tie relationships as friction-free. Technology makes it easy to communicate when we wish and to disengage at will. So there's a lot that's involved with, a lot of control involved with these things, the need for control. Back to texting. She says it offers just the right amount of access, just the right amount of control. These are people who take comfort in being in touch with a lot of people whom they also keep at bay. She said after many interviews, she said, I find people genuinely terrified of being cut off from the grid. People say that the loss of a cell phone can feel like a death. Our new devices provide space for the emergence of a new state of self, split between the screen and the physical real, wired into existence through technology. She says that these devices for people are like a phantom limb, always on and always on them. She makes the point that many of you already know, that teenagers flee the telephone. Perhaps more surprisingly, so do adults. They avoid voice communication outside of a small circle because it demands their full attention when they don't want to give it. Not only do people say that a phone call asks too much, they worry it will be received as demanding too much. She quotes an Audrey, a young Audrey. She does everything she can to avoid a call. The phone, Audrey says, it's awkward. I don't see the point. Too much just a recap and sharing feelings. With a text, I can answer on my own time. I can respond. I can ignore it. So it really works with my mood. I'm not bound to anything. No commitment. I have control, there's that word again, over the conversation, and also more control over what I say. Texting offers protection, the author says. Then Audrey makes up a new word. A text, she argues, is better than a call because in a call there is a lot less boundness to the person. By this she means that in a call she could learn too much or say too much and things could get out of control. A call has insufficient boundaries. The author says that what Audrey likes least about a call is the end of conversations. A phone call, she explains, requires the skill to end a conversation when you have no real reason to leave. It's not like there is a reason. You just want to. I don't know how to do that. I don't want to learn. The author says it is easier to avoid the phone. Its beginnings and endings are too rough on her. And this is what I got most out of this book, is the toll that this technology, and especially the social media technology, the toll it takes on young people, above all. Don't have time for it in this Taisho. Maybe I've been gearing up for Taisho on anxiety in general, and I may bring more of this into that. But it's just so disheartening to hear how much anxiety young people bring on themselves through social media, Facebook and other social media. And that's even aside from the cruel uses of social media. There's a review of a book here called The Glass Cage. And this is by Nicholas Carr, whose previous book was called The Shallows. The reviewer here, Daniel Menaker, describes that as essential reading about our internet age. This one is more about digital technology in effect, in general. So here's another one, a book called The Dangerous Powers of the E-Personality by an Elias Abujody. And this is another review of, this too is a review of that book by William Salatin. In the past 5 years, Americans have doubled the hours they spend online, exceeding their television time and more than tripling the time they spend reading newspapers or magazines. Now, most now play computer or video games regularly, about 13 hours a week on average. By age 21, the average young American has spent at least three times as many hours playing virtual games as reading. And then the author of this book, The Dangerous Powers of E-Personality, he's, by the way, a Silicon Valley psychiatrist, finds this alarming. In Virtually You, he argues that the Internet is unleashing our worst instincts. Okay, everyone here knows that, but let's just play it out a little more. It connects you to whatever you want: gambling, overspending, sex with strangers. It speeds transactions, facilitating impulse purchases and luring you away from the difficulties of real life. It lets you customize your fantasies and select a date from millions of profiles, sapping your patience for imperfect partners. It lets you pick congenial news sources and avoid contrary views and information. It conceals your identity, freeing you to be vitriolic or dishonest. It shields you from detection and disapproval, emboldening you to download test answers and term papers. It hides the pain of others, liberating your cruelty in games and forums. It rewards self-promotion on blogs and Facebook. It teaches you how to induce bulimic vomiting or kill yourself. In short, everything you thought was good about the Internet, information, access, personalization, is bad. And this is the reviewer saying, Abu Jaudi isn't shy in his indictment. He links the Internet to consumer debt, the housing crash, eating disorders, sexually transmitted infections, psychopathy, racism, terrorism, child sexual abuse, suicide, and murder. You know, it would be nice if we could laugh at this listing of things, but there's truth to this. Everything online worries him. Ads, hyperlinks, even emoticons. The Internet makes us too quarrelsome. It makes us too like-minded. It makes us work too little. It makes us work too much. In my reading for this, I ran across a concept I'd never heard of before, referenced, called the Ring of Gygas. And I Googled it, and using technology. And by the way, I'm not saying anyone needs to give up this stuff. Please, I use some of this, although mostly it's email and the occasional Google, but it's the balance of it. It's learning to use technology as the means to an end and not an end in itself, and getting swallowed up in it. That's what leaves me so concerned. Anyway, about the Ring of Gygas, Plato, in 380 BC, wrote about the myth of the Ring of Gygas, in which the shepherd, Gygas, discovers a ring that makes him invisible at will. Gygas promptly uses the protection this offers to infiltrate the royal household, seduce the queen, assassinate the king, and take the kingdom. The idea here is that anonymity, in a sense, can corrupt even the most moral of people. Given the chance to hide behind a computer screen, it's amazing what some of these keyboard warriors will say. So it's a phenomenon whereby Internet users experience a loss of inhibition that they would otherwise not experience face to face. It is here in the depositories of namelessness that the Internet troll is conceived. Their previous sense of empathy shuts down, and they enter a world without filters or contrition. This makes it very easy to pretend that there isn't an actual human being at the other end of their assaults. To them, it's simply words on a screen. And that leads me to an article called "The Epidemic of Facelessness." And this is by Stephen Marsh. He talks about these things online about threats to kill or to rape, and then he says, when the police come to the doors of the young men and women who send notes telling strangers that they want to rape them, they and their parents are almost always shocked, genuinely surprised that anyone would take what they said seriously, that anyone would take anything said online seriously. There is a vast dissonance between virtual communication and an actual police officer at the door. It is a dissonance we are running up against more and more, the dissonance between the world of faces and the world without faces. And the world without faces is coming to dominate. He says that in Twitter, faceless rage is inherent to its technology. He says it's not Twitter's fault that human beings use it, but the faceless communication social media creates, the linked distances between people, both provokes and mitigates the inherent capacity for monstrosity. The Gygas effect, he says, produces an inevitable reaction, the desire for impact at any cost. He says that the challenge of our moment is that the face has been at the root of justice and ethics for 2,000 years. A world stripped of faces is a world stripped not merely of ethics, but of the biological and cultural foundation of ethics. The spirit of facelessness is coming to define the 21st century. As exchange and communication come at a remove, the flight back to the face takes on new urgency. Google recently reported that on Android alone, which has more than a billion active users, people take 93 million selfies a day. The selfie has become not a single act, but a continuous process of self-portraiture. On the phones that are so much of our lives, no individual self-image is adequate. Instead, a rapid progression of self-images mimics the changeability and the variety of real human presence. He says that emojis are an explicit attempt to replicate the emotional context that facial expression provides. And then he passes on the conventional wisdom that the more that with trolls, internet trolls, the best thing is to disengage. And he then finally says, in a world without faces, compassion is a practice that requires discipline, even imagination. Social media seems so easy. The whole point of its pleasure is its sense of casual familiarity. But we need a new art of conversation for the new conversations we are having. And the first rule of that art must be to remember that we are talking to human beings. And then he offers a couple quotes here, doesn't attribute them. Never say anything online that you wouldn't say to somebody's face. But also, don't listen to what people wouldn't say to your face. So here's another quality, besides compassion, another quality that we develop through practice is discipline, self-discipline, holding back, considering before venting, online or face-to-face for that matter. The neurological research demonstrates that empathy, far from being an artificial construct of civilization, is integral to our biology. And when biological intersubjectivity disappears, when the face is removed from life, empathy and compassion can no longer be taken for granted. here's some scattered things I picked up from a conversation on civility and uncivility that appeared on the Diane, was broadcast on the Diane Rehm show. Deborah Tannen says, civility is not just superficial, pinky-in-the-air stuff. We don't need to be prissy about conversation, but this seems to be the time for a corrective of sorts, at least for a while. Zazen. What do you think? Here's an article by a Sumi London Kim, who is the Buddhist chaplain at Duke University, minister to the Buddhist families of Durham, and editor of the anthologies Blue Jean Buddha and the Buddha's Apprentices. And it's called Why I Quit Facebook. My Facebook addiction began 6 years ago when my husband said to me, with no apparent irony, "Facebook is so cool. Why don't you join so we can become friends?" A year later, we relocated to a city where we had no friends or family. The lively and loving exchanges with old friends through Facebook mitigated my sudden isolation and got me through a pretty rough year. Eventually, I made friends in the new city, but my Facebook habit continued. In fact, it intensified. After 5 years of clicking through the news feed, however, disenchantment began to creep in. Who would have guessed that normally exciting stuff could become so repetitive? Same old, same old. Snapshots of chic restaurant meals, babies, vacations, calls to rally around causes. Oh my God, how many causes can someone take on? Snippets of wisdom from Buddhist teachers, cartoons, jokes. I became further disenchanted when I realized I was using Facebook for approval, a sense of belonging, and subtle self-promotion. And I often mentally rebuked some of my Buddhist friends for their own blatant egotism. I then made a commitment not to post anything personal. Using the guidelines of right speech, I only commented on others' status updates and posted what I found truly useful, uplifting, and funny. Doing this helped me recognize where Facebook was entangling my ego. It also changed the way I sought approval and friendship. Now these came from the people around me rather than through online connections. Paring back on my posting showed me how I had been living my life through Facebook status possibilities rather than just being in and enjoying the moment. Anything interesting was now a potential status update, and I would spend a lot of time formulating the most clever, attention-grabbing wording. A fairly universal trait of Facebook users. It was like looking at life through a camera. That distanced quality was increasingly incongruent with what I was trying to do in meditation practice. Looking at life through a camera. There's an article about tweeting here that is saying pretty much the same thing. But just to slide over to this one. It's called I Tweet, Therefore I Am. A part of my consciousness had split off and was observing the scene from the outside. The Twitterati's unnatural self-consciousness, processing my experience instantaneously, packaging life as I lived it. Yet the final decision was not really about my own impressions. It was about how I imagined and wanted others to react to them. That gave me pause. How much, I began to wonder, was I shaping my Twitter feed, and how much was Twitter shaping me? This is by Peggy Ornstein. Back in the 1950s, the sociologist Irving Goffman famously argued that all of life is performance. We act out a role in every interaction, adapting it based on the nature of the relationship or context at hand. Twitter has extended that metaphor to include aspects of our experience that used to be considered offset: eating pizza in bed, reading a book in the tub, thinking a thought anywhere, flossing. Effectively, it makes the grease paint permanent, blurring the lines not only between public and private, but also between the authentic and contrived self. If all the world was once a stage, it has now become a reality TV show. We mere players are not just aware of the camera, we mug for it. Encouraging self-promotion over self-awareness. And now back to young woman's, this Sumi Lunden Kim, why she gave up Facebook. Last December's shooting in Newtown, Connecticut gave me a whole new angle on Facebook's impact. One of the first things I did after hearing the news was to scroll through the news feed. I wondered why I had this impulse. Observing my grief-stricken and terrified mind, I saw that I was looking for comfort from others. But what actually happened was that other people's outrage and anguish intensified my own. I was searching for a sense of connection, but as soon as I walked away from the computer, I was alone in my empty apartment. What I needed was physical comfort, a hug to hold and to be held by others. That Facebook cannot provide, yet I would return to it again and again, searching for what was not there. Daily meditation practice began revealing to me how living in continual distraction robbed me of so much. When I rested my attention on the breath and let go of distractions, thoughts about Facebook being one of them, my mind felt restored, revitalized, made whole in a very pleasurable way. I began noticing how my online habits were splitting my attention and reducing my quality of life. One time I was tootling away on Facebook, my back turned to the family, when my 4-year-old son came up to me to talk and cuddle. I told him to go play. Noticing this and similar instances, I made a rule not to use my computer unless the kids were in bed or at school. That was when I discovered the strength of my addiction. One day, while watching my kids at the park, I literally had to sit on my hands to keep myself from sneaking a peek at my phone. What I felt was, the present moment is really boring in comparison to what's happening online. What's happening online is more like a big, chatty, nonstop party. In the middle of the night in early January, it hit me that, taken altogether, the repetitiveness, self-promotion, superficial sense of belonging, fractured attention, disconnection with those present around me, and my addictedness, Facebook was doing me more the harm than good. I couldn't wait until the morning to shut down that damn account. And then she still remains off it. She saw all kinds of benefits of having got off it. She realized she had been living with a divided mind, one in reality and one in a kind of mental dialogue with my online media world. My mind had been playing a continuous loop, asking and answering 7 questions at all times, even when I was away from a computer or tech gear. Here are the questions. What's new on Facebook? Did an email come in? Did I get a text that I might have missed? Who's on Google Chat now? What's new on Huffington Post in the news cycle? Is my phone ringer at the right setting so I can hear it? Did I miss a call? Are there any messages on the home answering machine? And she says, as I'm letting go of the alternate reality of the online world, I find myself much more attuned to actual reality. I am more interested in the people right in front of me because I am not half attending to the virtual people online. I kind of feel like I am waking up. Oh, wow, there's a blue sky. There's the sound of birds chirping. My daughter is giving me a big hug right now. It has been fascinating to feel my attention restored to greater wholeness. I have a lot more buoyant mental energy, and I can feel a certain return of tranquility as well as a willingness to think about one thing at a time more deeply rather than many things in a cursory, shallow manner. And that's it for that testimony. This in back to Sherry Turkle's book, this second part, the first part I said, the first half of the book is about robot companionship, and then the second one she calls networked, and it's basically, she says, it's about how the net prepares us for the relationships with less that robots provide. Some other things she points out, we tend the net, and the net teaches us to need it. Moments of more may leave us with lives of less. Networked, we are together, but so lessened are our expectations of each other that we can feel utterly alone. Then she talks about travel and how it's changed travel. She makes the point that leaving home has always been a way to see one's culture anew. Many people hearing this have had that experience. I remember the first time I went abroad to Europe. I got a whole new perspective on my own country and my own culture. But she says, what if tethered we bring our homes with us? And she makes the point, now we can always be elsewhere. And I would say that travel, our own meditation version of that is in going to Sesshin. In going to Sesshin, if it does nothing else, it gives us a new perspective on ourselves, on others, on our lives, our circumstances, our jobs, our family, a new perspective. And that's why we can never allow people to remain tethered in Sesshin to their smartphones or other digital technology. She says, regarding this dependency on technology, today our dream machine is to be never alone, but always in control. She insists that the lure of internet relationships, constantly available but inherently superficial, might make both genuine connection and genuine solitude impossible. This is what is so poignant about this: is this need for connecting, for intimacy, and yet never this way, really finding genuine intimacy. There's an article by Sherry Turkle herself. This is the same author who wrote the book Alone Together, called The Flight from Conversation. We think that our sips of online connection add up to a gulp. They don't. She goes into a lot into identity. How we touched on this last week, how our identity through social media becomes externally constructed. It's a new way of constituting a self. And because it's based on extrinsic material and feedback, it's hollow. This is the real danger, is not developing any sense of integrity of the self. And as a result, there are all these problems with anxiety and self-esteem. Presentation anxiety is one of these. Girls use shrinking software to appear thinner on their profile photographs. What a tragedy! That because also she compares it to identity as an adolescent issue. Adolescence is a time where for building a sense of identity, and yet we're left, for too much dependence on this, we're left without any real sense of identity. And from that come all kinds of issues of privacy. She says, traditionally, the development of intimacy required privacy. Intimacy without privacy reinvents what intimacy means. Separation, too, is being reinvented. Tethered children know they have a parent on tap, a text or a call away. And then she I won't even get into all of the alternate identity material that she talks about, developing an avatar, developing an alternate identity. This too is beyond the scope of anything we can cover here. Well, our time is up now. There's so much more I could have gotten into, and maybe someday I'll finish this and as part of another kind of Teisho. But for now, we'll stop and recite the four vows.